And welcome, beloved listeners. You might recall that on our first program for the week, we looked at the war in Gaza through a particular prism, what the Israeli military called Operation Protective Edge. What effect is it having on the Palestinian leadership? Our focus was on Hamas, the local branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, and we looked at their difficulties, not only within Gaza, but from Egypt across the region. In tonight's program, we will turn our attention to how the war might influence who's running things in Tel Aviv, because there are fracture lines there, as dramatized by Netanyahu's sacking of a defense minister in the middle of the conflict. But before I introduce my distinguished commentators, let me tell you what else the program holds. In 1961, a 23-year-old Harvard graduate and heir to the Rockefeller fortune, young Michael, the younger son of Nelson, who was then the New York governor, disappeared off the coast of what was then Dutch New Guinea. Michael was on an expedition to collect what was called primitive art for his father's new museum in New York, and his catamaran capsized. He decides to swim ashore and was never seen again, at least by white men. Now, at the time, I was a year younger and was avidly collecting, primitive art on the other side of that extraordinary place, my focus being on the Sepik River, Maprik, and offshore on the Trobriand. So I followed the mystery of Michael Rockefeller very, very closely indeed. And a mystery it has remained ever since. But tonight's guest, Carl Hoffman, thinks he has solved it, and we will hear what he has to say towards the end of the program. Now, the collateral damage in terms of party politics may seem a trivial aspect of what's happening in Gaza, but in Israeli politics, success or failure in military operations often have important, very important political consequences. So who may be challenging Netanyahu? To help us out, we welcome back to LNL Meir Jamdara, who's the editor of an Israel Observer and director of the Middle East Economic and Political Analysis Group in Tel Aviv. And with me in Sydney is Dr. Gil Meron, a political scientist from the Department of Government and International Relations and the Centre for International Security at the University of Sydney. Meir, I want to start with you. You wrote recently, when it comes to dealing with Palestinians, Netanyahu was all about tactics, not strategy. Fighting Hamas is a tactic. If he had an actual strategy to address Israel's security challenges, he would have taken negotiations with the PLO seriously. Instead, he drove them away from the table by building more settlements. What are we witnessing currently in Gaza? Tactics or strategy?
Hi, Philip. Thank you for the invitation. It's great to be on your show again. What we're seeing in Gaza right now is a tactic. It's an important tactic. I don't think any country can live with the fact that a third of its citizens are sleeping in bomb shelters every night. And Netanyahu is doing what is necessary to ensure that the threat of missiles from Gaza is at least minimized. But, you know, this in itself is not going to be enough, which is why I just called it a tactic. In order to really tackle this threat of terrorism against Israel, we need to have a strategy, one which involves the military, but also has diplomatic parts. It's like a concert. Both have to play in sequence. You know, the late Yitzhak Rabin said we have to fight terrorism as if there's no peace, and we have to make peace as if there's no terrorism. And here's what we should do. Why, if Hamas attacks us, to reply in kind while trying to minimize the civilian casualties in Gaza. But when there are moderates on the Palestinian side, such as Mr. Mahmoud Abbas, who does want to live in peace with us, and when he wants to deal with us, instead of humiliating him and isolating him in front of his own people by building more settlements. We should be helping him. We should be helping him develop his economy so that when Palestinians look at those who cooperate with Israel, they actually live well, then that could encourage more Palestinians to want to cooperate with us and to reach a deal.
Gil, you've just returned from a political science conference in Israel, and I wonder whether the political divisions in the Israeli cabinet that have arisen since the war started were evident when you were there.
The fact of the matter is that usually in security crises, the prime minister, at least initially, enjoys a rally around the flag impact, and that this case is no different from others, and only more so because it was a clear case that Hamas pretty much dragged Netanyahu after some initial maneuvers into getting involved deeper and deeper. So I think that in a way, Netanyahu had more political problems before this current stage of the conflict than now. For example, Naftali Bennett, who's the head of the third largest party, the Jewish Home, was very fervent against Netanyahu before the shooting started, but as of the time the shooting started, Netanyahu's position has increased. Naftali Bennett moved aside. There's no more conflict at present. So I think generally, as long as the war goes more or less as planned, casualties do not accumulate to too high proportions, then Netanyahu probably, as we see in recent polls, Netanyahu's standing is strengthened, and his political enemies are not going to go against him at present.
Gil, I want to come back to Bennett later, but tell me about the firing of the defense minister. What's going on there?
There was a firing of the deputy defense minister, Danon. Danon has some powerful position within Likud, but he is a backbencher essentially. He's not one of the leading personalities in Likud. He does represent, I think, a constituency. He's not alone there, that mounted a challenge to Netanyahu and want to drag him further to the right. In a sense, in the recent election in 2013, the more quote-unquote moderate, but I would say the more civilized members of the right-wing Likud were voted out of the list, and the younger backbenchers that are much more vulgar and much more vocal assumed some positions of power. Danon is a representative of this crowd, and he went head-on against Netanyahu, and Netanyahu did whatever, he didn't have much choice politically, but fired him. Because it is during a conflict, and if the conflict eventually ends up in a ceasefire that will be acceptable to the Israeli public, I believe that Dadi Danon, from a political point of view, made a huge blunder for himself, and Netanyahu will use this as well.
I want to go back to Meir in just a second, but first of all, picking you up in your comments about the head of the Jewish Home Party, is he a potential PM, or does he see himself in that role?
In the past, he does see himself as a contender. More recently, said that he does not see himself as a contender, but I think politics is politics. It's very volatile. And I'm sure that in his heart, and the heart of any politician in Israel or leading party, there is this hope that one day he, she will become the prime minister. All of them tried. Naftali Bennett is young, and he wants to lead the right wing as much as Avigdor Lieberman wants to lead the right wing. I think he's pretty clever, but with his agenda, which is essentially the settlers' agenda, I don't see him in, say, the next couple of years leading the right wing.
Meir, tell me what you think of Bennett. Is he waiting for Netanyahu to stumble?
Everybody.
I have to agree with Gil there. Everybody in Israel... Israel is a country full of prime ministers. I mean, you come and sit on a Tel Aviv bus, you'll meet about 50 potential prime ministers. So now imagine, you know, people getting to the top, somebody like Naftali Bennett. I'm sure he harbors these desires and these ambitions. But, I mean, I've heard him speak. I mean, this is a man who wants to forget about returning 60% of the West Bank. He wants to annex it. And he was talking about reoccupying Gaza. I mean, yes, this is music to the ears of some minority in Israel, but to be honest with you, in the world that we are living today, this is very scary.
Let me just give people a feeling of his rhetorical style. This is from a speech he gave at Brookings. In Gaza, we kicked out 8,000 Jews from their houses forcefully. It's free of Jews. Yet days after leaving Gaza, they began shooting missiles. So what we learn, not once, not twice, but three times, this isn't working. And their desire for state conflict with our desire to be, to live. So, Gil, he doesn't mince words.
No, but as I said, he represents the settlers, and ideologically he's also committed to this line. I think he's also a political creature, so he has to mobilize his crowd. He has changed his opinion, or it sounds like he's changed tactically his opinion here and there. And if he would wish to become a prime minister, his messages probably will go to the center. But as I said before,
prime ministers invariably do. Some observers, Gil, think that Netanyahu has succeeded in fending off the hard right by the ground invasion of Gaza.
To some degree, but everything is transient in the Middle East. I mean, there will be after the war. At some point it will end in the next few days, weeks. So, and it will be washed off the table.
It may only end for a short period. The other night, John Stewart on The Daily Show ran an American journalist saying exactly the same words over and over and over again as the war in Gaza reignites. It was deja vu to the power of four.
Right, but I think in the Middle East, and particularly vis-a-vis Gaza, the issue for the Israeli government, and that's most of the people that speak about it in positions of power in Israel say the same, is to gain as much as possible window of peace or ceasefire or whatever. And I think that this experience for Hamas as well, and since Hamas is probably after financial support, opening the gates for supply to Gaza, etc., it may end up with an extended period of ceasefire, extended for years, not for decades. And that's all the government want. And remember, government live until the next election.
Good point. Elinel on RN, Meir Jadnafa is my guest, director of the Middle East Economic and Policy Analysis Group in Israel, and sitting with me here in Sydney, Dr. Gil Meron, Department of Government and International Relations and the Centre for International Security at the University of Sydney. Meir, how much is Israeli decision-making about security, foreign policy, affected by international criticism of its military strategy in Gaza, which, as we all must acknowledge, is beyond a crescendo?
Actually, I have to respectfully disagree with you there, Philip. I think that compared to other conflicts right now, the level of criticism has actually been lower. It is impacted, but I think what's more important when it comes to national security decision making in Israel is first of all the intensity of the threat which Israel is facing, and whether it can meet them by showing a strong military muscle. And then I think public opinion at home, that's second most important. And the third most important is as you said, it's international criticism. For now, actually, it seems that international criticism has been lower than other operations. The reason being that
some of it's distracted, of course, by MH17.
Exactly, and also because Netanyahu offered a ceasefire to Hamas on Tuesday. Well, they made the mistake of actually not consulting Hamas about it, but the ceasefire agreement was backed by the entire Arab League, with the exception of Qatar, the Egyptians, they completely back Israel on this. Hamas said no. Then there was another ceasefire Israel proposed for humanitarian reasons on Thursday. Israel stopped firing. Guess what? Hamas kept on firing. The international community sees this. And for now, this plus the fact that al-Sisi, it seems, the general al-Sisi, the president of Egypt, seems more determined to see Hamas weaken than Netanyahu. This puts Hamas in a very weak corner diplomatically, which is why until now the pressure has not been as much. However, it could change overnight, especially if there's a massive spike in the number of Palestinian casualties.
Gil?
Uh, first of all, I agree with Meir. I think he's up to the point, but I think we should divide it. Politically, Israel sees support. It sees support from the U.S., from the U.S. president. It sees support from European leaders like the German chancellor and the French president. So at the political level, the only quote-unquote vocal criticism of Israel comes mainly from Turkey, Iran, Venezuela. These are a group of countries that are set aside, I believe. There is some backlash against Israel, significant in public opinion, world public opinion. In terms of Israeli preferences or attention, first come Israel security needs, second come Israeli public opinion, and then American and European. So on this front, Netanyahu enjoys the support for all the reasons that Meir notified, including the fact that Hamas shells constantly Jewish civilian population in Israel, which is by definition a war crime. Nobody likes Hamas in the Middle East, except they're only perhaps, as Mary noted, Iran, to some degree, though Hamas had some feud with Syria and Iran, Qatar perhaps, but mainly Turkey. And the Turkish aspiring president is considered to some degree a punk. He picks up a fight with everybody in the Middle East and outside the Middle East. So I think that for the time being, Israel feels confident enough to apply force. And surprisingly, relative to what we see in the Middle East, with far more caution, although the catastrophic consequences for the residents of Gaza are obvious.
Back to you, Meir, if I might. I take your point, the point both of you make, that there are a great many potential prime ministers rushing around Tel Aviv, just as everyone who goes to Canberra in Australia has the baton in his luggage, his or her luggage. I'd like you to tell me, Meir, how this is playing out with that, in that cauldron of public opinion in Israel.
To be honest with you, people are right now too busy. When there's a siren, people are, you know, you can imagine the psychological damage it does. You know, my wife is from Colombia and she is not used to it. You should see the terror on her face every time there's a siren. I don't take it so seriously because I was brought up during the Iran-Iraq war in Tehran, and this is diet war compared to what I went through as a child in Iran during the Iran-Iraq war. But people are very concerned about the sirens. People are obsessed by the news of the Israeli casualties in Gaza. And people are, for now, just focusing on what is happening in Gaza, praying that the number of Israeli casualties is low, praying that the number of Palestinian casualties is low. You know, people in Palestine, in Gaza, dying makes nobody happy in Israel. And for now, this is the focus. We have to wait and see, Philip, how this war ends, how this war pans out. And then we can see what the long-term consequences are going to be. But for now, we are far too close to the picture to be able to give a definite overall definition of what's going to happen.
Back to you, Gil.
Generally agree with Meir again. I think that in terms of Israeli public opinion, Israelis are first sensitive to their own casualties, and most Israelis, but not all, look with sadness on the civilian casualties in Gaza. There is a small vocal minority in Israel that is extreme right-wing, that we haven't seen before in Israel. It's accumulating some force that rejoices at casualties in Gaza and attacks left-wing, if you will, or extreme left-wing demonstration inside Israel. But the general sense is that Israelis don't want to see casualties, civilian casualties on the other side, mainly for instrumental, but also for moral reason. It's very clear to all Israelis that it doesn't serve the Israeli purpose. Having said that, public opinion, I think we should remember, is very volatile. If casualties accumulate, it may turn into a backlash against Netanyahu, as much as the previous prime minister and Olmert suffered after the Lebanon war.
It was put to me on Monday night that the last thing that Netanyahu really wants is to see the destruction, the demolition of Hamas, because that might open up a very, very serious vacuum, which could be filled by much more radical groups, like we're seeing rampaging across Iraq. How do you feel about that argument?
That's one, definitely, Philip. That's one school of thought that's very prevalent in this part in Israel, that people don't want Hamas decapitated, because at the end of the day they are the, you know, they are the least of the devils in the least of the bad guys in Gaza. But there's another school of thought that's actually developing here in Israel that says no, that actually Hamas has to be removed from power, because as long as it feels that Israel is going to need them and is going to have to deal with them, they're going to feel that they can call the shots, and that in fact we should go for complete removal of Hamas from Gaza and its replacement with Fatah, the PLO. And actually, prior to this conflict, Washington Institute, I think in Washington, had a poll that said that actually showed that the majority of people of Gaza wanted the PLO back. So there is the second school of thought that's developing. And to be honest with you, the longer this war continues, I think the more the leadership could be, and I emphasize the word could, be drawn towards the option of removing Hamas, because I think actually that's the option that ultimately Egypt would like as well.
Gil, you clearly want to comment on this issue?
Again, I think the analysis is proper. Generally, I think that at this point, Israeli leadership still tends to see Hamas as the only unpleasant option in Gaza. It's very important for Israel to have an address. And the options of having movements like we see in Syria, the Sunnis in Syria, the wild Sunnis in Syria, increasing their power, Islamic Jihad, but also the current Salafi kind of organization, is more dangerous than Hamas. Hamas can be dealt with. Sure, in the heart of heart, Israel would prefer to see the control of the PLO previously kicked out of Gaza, and the pressure applied to Hamas in recent years, including blockade, in some respect was to discredit it in the eyes of Palestinian residents of Gaza. I don't think it's for real, though.
Okay, in winding this up, I have to say that I accept your argument that Israel is not isolated at a political level by very critical countries around the world, but it's certainly isolated by global public opinion. And one of the problems, of course, is that while Israel faces this constant rain of terror, literally, from the skies, the death toll has been so grotesquely uneven. Almost all the victims on the Israeli side are serving troops. 800-plus civilians, and the images of children being killed in large numbers makes, I think, Israel's global position in terms of international public opinion very difficult.
That is correct in terms of public opinion. I think public opinion sees numbers and doesn't count who started and what's the objective and conduct and intentions. The fact of the matter is that Hamas denies the right of Israel to exist. So for Israel, it's a question of survival, if you will, or in the long run, it's an existential issue. Choose to tell the civil casualties in Gaza don't serve the Israeli purpose. They do serve the Hamas purpose, paradoxically. And the world doesn't like to see the big guy, the powerful guy, beating up the weak guy, even if the weak guy is a wicked weak guy. That's unfortunate, and sure, Israel should exercise restraint as much as possible, but in this case, the Israeli government was pushed to extreme. If you will, the fact of the matter in the Middle East is that both extremes feed one the other. Radical behavior of Hamas feeds a radical right in Israel, and vice versa.
Gentlemen, I thank you. That was Gil Meron, Department of Government and International Relations and the Centre for International Security of the University of Sydney, and our regular guest, Meir Chaffin-Danfa, Director, Middle East Economic and Political Analysis Group in Israel. This is LNL on RN, and coming up, as I promised you, perhaps a solution to the mystery of the death of young Rockefeller.